Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers, and $30 coin packs are on sale for 10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Gary Rivlin, the journalist and our guide to the AI Valley, Artificial Intelligence Valley, once Silicon Valley, now Aon Valley. Microsoft, Google, the big guys, and the trillion-dollar pace race to cash in on artificial intelligence. This is AI, and Gary does us the favor of demythologizing it by concentrating on the personalities. Always the same, no matter the invention or wealth, always the same. And the origins of AI, which are in the 20th century, but really everything that's important that we're hearing about now has happened within years. Gary, congratulations. This is a very helpful book to understand all the chatter that's going on about AI. I begin with a man whose personality is in all directions in your book, Reid Hoffman. He is a polymath. At the same time, he charms people. What's the gift that he has? Who is he, and what do we need to know about him, Gary? Good evening to you.
All right, great to be on. So, you know, I mean, Reid Hoffman, he's been called the best connected person in Silicon Valley. He just has this open personality. He's just endlessly curious. What's remarkable about Silicon Valley is sort of the remarkable individuals in Silicon Valley. They're a quest for learning. They always want to learn, and Hoffman really embodies that. And for, you know, this book, he's the co-founder of LinkedIn. That's what he's best known for. He was among the first investors in Facebook, Airbnb, and so he's a venture capitalist these days. So he's really known as a founder and an investor, but also just kind of a thought leader and writing a book about AI. So since the mid-2010s, you know, he's been investing in AI. He was one of the original investors in OpenAI, which gave us ChatGPT. He started investing in autonomous vehicles in 2017, and then in 2022, he co-founded a company called Inflection, which in a way created my favorite chatbot. It didn't just have IQ, like they all do, but EQ, emotional intelligence. So you could talk to it. It felt more like talking to a human than the others. So just the idea of just telling the story of AI through Hoffman just seemed a really inviting way for readers, you know, a way to have a kind of a character you could root for. He's very relatable. I mean, he's a multi-billionaire, but doesn't quite live like one. And so I just saw kind of going on the journey through AI as told through Reid Hoffman, but be a way for readers to go on the journey with him.
Born in the summer of love, 1967, in Palo Alto, California, attended Stanford University, but critical is the perception he has of his childhood. He was lonely. How did he translate that into the positive person that he is? What's your measure, Gary?
Right. You know, he was a misfit, you know, kind of, you know, one of those adults in a child's body. Like, you know, he didn't have many, if any, friends, and just spent his time in, you know, going to the library, taking out books about science fiction, got into Dungeons and Dragons. But, you know, really kind of in two ways, I really feel that his childhood shaped him. One, he became really, really good at games. Dungeons and Dragons, war games, all these different games. And it gave him a great strategic sense, which would really serve him well as a founder and an investor. You know, but more than that, he had this hunger to connect. I don't think it's any coincidence he created LinkedIn. In fact, in the mid-1990s, in 1997, he created co-founded this company called SocialNet. And it was really the start of social media. He was, you know, among the people who, for better or for worse, gave us social media. And I really think the drive there was here was a human who just thirsted for human connection, found it at Stanford, kind of an intellectual connection, but just really wanted to bring people together. And, you know, social.net, which was before his time, so it didn't quite work, but then LinkedIn was a huge success. And then just kind of his whole being became meeting with interesting people, meeting with potential founders, and that's the way he met the likes of Mark Zuckerberg and all. He just liked meeting people, and it's really served him well.
One of his acquaintances, colleagues at Stanford, happened to be Peter Thiel. And what is striking also, there's so many themes that are revealed in your book, Gary, is that we're dealing with the same small group of men all the time.
So, I mean, the Peter Thiel Reid Hoffman friendship is so interesting. They met in their sophomore year, and they both joke, you know, I interviewed them both, that, you know, they started arguing. One's very conservative, Peter Thiel, one's very liberal, Reid Hoffman. And they basically, you know, had a 2-hour debate the first time they met, and they just kept that debate going for years and years and years. And in fact, Peter after social.net didn't work, Hoffman went to work for Thiel at PayPal. And so, you know, Hoffman was a key early employee at PayPal. And when it went public and then was bought for about $1.5 billion by eBay, that gave him the stake he needed to start investing as an angel investor. But yeah, I mean, that friendship, I used to, it was sort of like the Brat Pack of Silicon Valley. You know, you had Peter Thiel and Elon Musk, Reid Hoffman, Mark Pincus, a group of others that were friends. They invested in each other's companies. They founded companies. And so, I mean, you know, I think that could cut both ways to, you know, talk about artificial intelligence. That Silicon Valley way of getting five smart guys in a room won't quite cut it for artificial intelligence. And, you know, we could get into that later. But, you know, that is Silicon Valley. It's this sprawling place, but it's very small when you look at, you know, who knows who and who's connected.
I don't want to go really fast the Elon Musk, because once Peter Thiel appears, I know I have an anticipation. There's something of the drama of a theater piece in your book, Gary. I mean, I felt any moment now Musk is going to walk on stage. Indeed, he does. And he and Thiel put PayPal together, and then it's sold to eBay. Hoffman is watching this the whole time. But Musk's personality comes back again and again. So I want to establish that this is early Musk before his billions. And yet it's the same Musk. He must dominate. Does Hoffman have an opinion of that?
He does. I mean, you know, let's give Musk his due. He, along with Peter Thiel, was one of the first investors in AI, dating back to the early 2010s, before any venture capitalist, before any investor was taking it as a serious money-making opportunity. Musk, Thiel, a few others were brave enough to invest in this early AI company based in London called DeepMind. But, you know, I think Hoffman has a nuanced view of Musk. I mean, he kind of embodies the best of Silicon Valley. He just takes big swings. You know, I mean, you know, electric cars, spaceships, you know, Neuralink, which is the idea of implanting a chip in the brain so your brain could do the movement, control the movements of your body. I mean, you know, for people who, you know, have a spinal injury and all. I mean, he really is just sort of that kind of entrepreneur who strives to do things that really matter. On the other hand, you know, Hoffman uses the term God complex for Musk. Like, you know, everything will be okay so long as I, Elon Musk, is in charge. And, you know, that's frustrating to people who see more of a cooperative approach to a startup, to technology, the development of technology.
At Oxford, where Reid Hoffman attended Oxford after Stanford University, he got a master's at Oxford, he was familiar with the concept of computers. I mean, the big thinking about working together. And so he was always thinking about it philosophically. Is that correct, Gary?
Right. Actually, he went to Oxford to study philosophy. He thought he'd get a PhD in philosophy, but then he realized that, you know, getting a PhD in philosophy meant like writing papers and books for the 50 people who could understand it. He wanted to have more of an impact. In fact, his computer bona fides go back to Stanford. You know, he took this major, he majored at Stanford in what's called symbolic systems. And it was the idea of computer science mixed with linguistics and other disciplines, which is essentially what gave us artificial intelligence. He, you know, he took summer internships looking at working on artificial intelligence. So, you know, from early on, you know, he saw tech and computers, I mean, this dates back to the early 90s. He understood that tech and computers were going to be at the center of everything. AI, though, you know, he was frustrated by it. It seemed a very juvenile technology. Back then in the late 80s, you know, the cutting-edge researchers were trying to teach a computer to distinguish between a cat and a dog. And, you know, it felt like they were kindergarten teachers. And so, you know, a man like Hoffman who wanted to have his impact on the world, he left artificial intelligence until, in fact, a fateful dinner with Elon Musk in 2015, where Musk said, hey, I've invested in this company, DeepMind. AI is really starting to show some promise. You should look at it. And that, in fact, was the moment where Hoffman said, huh, okay, I'm going to take AI seriously.
The book is AI Valley, Microsoft, Google, and the $1 trillion race to cash in on our artificial intelligence. Gary Rivlin is the author. We're going back to the beginning, and that's the 1950s. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with Gary Rivlin. His new book, I highly recommend to all of you who see the word AI everywhere and go, what does that mean? AI Valley, Microsoft, Google, and the $1 trillion race to cash it, what's bigger than a trillion? It's that kind of scale. To cash in on artificial intelligence. The 1950s, a man named Rosenblatt has an idea. And the idea is that Isaac Asimov wasn't just making it up. We can actually create robots that have conversations with us and are human-like, humanoid. Rosenblatt's idea is taken up by the U.S. Navy. Why, Gary? Can we figure out what they saw in him?
Right. So, I mean, just to back up a little bit, you know, Frank Rosenblatt's idea was that it won't be just computers that follow instructions line by line, but actually learn and get better with training like a human would. And that's the foundation of today's, you know, AI revolution. And there seems a lot of potential. This is the late 1950s, you know, for military purposes, maybe it could be used to read radar, you know, accurately. The post office was interested. Maybe it could, you know, help sorting and the mail. So, you know, this idea that a computer could learn with training and get better was a really attractive idea to a lot of people. However, he was really before his time. He was kind of cast as a crazy guy. And, you know, most of the computer scientists through the 50s, 60s, 70s, into actually the 2000s and 2010s, they thought the idea was preposterous. You know, their approach was like, let's do what I call rules-based computing. We'll teach these computers the way all computers are taught, line by line by line. You know, if this happens, do that. If that happens, do this. You know, kind of thing. And so for like 50 years, this idea of neural networks, machine learning, a machine that would, you know, be trained and improve through training and fine-tuning was really seen as the wrong approach. It really wasn't until the 2010s that machine learning, neural networks, again, the basis of today's AI, or, you know, the most cutting-edge generative AI, became mainstream.
Frank Rosenblatt sees what the future is. However, a man named Marvin Minsky, who's a professor at MIT, believes that neural networks, that is, just throwing a lot of information into a computer's brain and letting it decide it can sort it out, that's a dead end. He has a rules-based approach that you report, Gary, made AI extremely unlikely and almost unpopular to the point that you shouldn't mention it. Is that correct?
Right. So, you know, I joke that, you know, since the 1950s, AI had been just around the next corner. There was a real optimism, over-optimism in AI among those who were working on it. They always thought, like, okay, in the next 10 years is going to start doing, you know, essential things. And that was a long ways away. You know, in defense of Minsky, I mean, he was an arrogant guy. He mocked, he ridiculed anyone who was taking this approach of neural networks. But, you know, computers weren't really strong enough. They didn't have the power that they have today. So, you know, neural networks, in a sense, were an idea before their time. You need data, you need digital data to train these. And really wasn't until the mid-1990s in the internet that we started to have digital data. And it's only in the last 10 or 20 years that we've had, you know, gobs of digital data. So between kind of the lack of power that computers had back then and the lack of digital data, I mean, even if we had gone on the neural network course, you know, dating back to the 1950s, I'm not sure how much sooner we would have gotten to, you know, ChatGPT and where we are now, but it really was this 50-year wrong turn.
We have two centers looking at at a brain that can act like a human. One is in Stanford. Chris Manning is mentioned as a organizer for Stanford, and the other is at MIT. And at this point, say it's 1967, when one of our protagonists is born. The understanding is AI is not growing. There's no money in it. Is that what you call a nuclear winter?
Yeah, the AI winter. There's been two AI winters. Again, it was kind of born in this optimism. So, you know, in the 60s and 70s, it wasn't just the U.S. military or the U.S. post office. There were a lot of corporations that saw a lot of potential here. I mean, giants like IBM, et cetera. And, you know, so there was all this hope and there was all this research dollars, you know, federal dollars, corporate dollars that went into AI, but it really wasn't getting anywhere. And so there was an AI winter in the 1970s where the funding dried up. And, you know, as you said before, AI, artificial intelligence, became a dirty word. Like if you want to raise money as for a grant, you would not use the term AI. And the same thing would happen a second time. There was this real flurry of activity in the 1980s, this idea of expert systems, like, hey, we could use, you're on an oil rig, you know, deep in the ocean, you know, you could use an expert system to monitor for safety. And so there was this kind of hype, I would say overhype, of like, hey, these expert systems are going to help run your essential infrastructure. And so again, a lot of money from corporate America, some research dollars, some companies went public, but they all went out of business. It fizzled. And so there was a AI winter in the late 1980s. And really, to me, it wasn't until the 2000s, if not the 2010s, that there was a full revival, that suddenly money was going back into AI again, whether from government grants or from venture capitalists or from large corporations.
The joke for programmers, Lisp was the language they favored at AI. Lots of idiotic, stupid parentheses.
Yeah, it's again, like some of the predictions, like, oh, within 10 years, a computer is going to beat the best chess masters. That did happen, but it wasn't until the mid-1990s, 1997.
Let's go forward, Gary. Gary Rivlin, AI Valley. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, spending time with the journalist and extremely helpful journalist, Gary Rivlin. His new book is AI Valley, Microsoft, Google, and the trillion-dollar race to cash in on artificial intelligence called AI. We need to meet the personalities who drive the development of what we now regard as magic. Mustafa Suleiman. Mustafa Suleiman is born overseas, and he is the child of Pakistani immigrants. His father, an engineer in Pakistan, is a taxi driver in London. You've spoken a great deal about AI with Mr. Suleiman. What's he like? What do we need to know about his personality?
Actually, Suleiman is Syrian. His father, in fact, did go to Pakistan. So Suleiman was fascinating. I joke he's the British version of the Silicon Valley archetype. He dropped out of Oxford, not Harvard or Stanford. So he, very curious mind. He was into politics. He worked for a little bit in negotiations with, you know, to help resolve conflict and all, but really wanted to make his impact. He was really inspired by Bill Gates, you know, raising all this money and then using that money to have an impact on the world. And, you know, by chance, he runs into a childhood friend, or the older brother of his best friend from childhood. They're actually playing poker at a casino in London. And, you know, the two of them, this is in 2010, the two of them start talking about the potential of artificial intelligence. It started with poker. Do you think we could create an AI that could be a master poker player? But, you know, it broadened from that. And, like, you know, they decided, like, well, it's too soon for robots, but machine learning, you know, had all this potential. The friend he was talking with was Demis Hassabis, who's one of the leading figures in AI. In fact, he won a Nobel Prize last year for his work in AI. And, you know, Hassabis, Suleiman, and a third man who also worked in machine learning created what to me is the first great AI start, the first great machine learning startup, DeepMind. This is in 2010 in London, and they really were at the cutting edge of trying to teach these models, you know, by letting it ingest data. And, you know, they started with games. You know, could we teach these models to these systems to learn to be masters of games? And they had a lot of success with that. But, you know, so in 2010, 2011, 2012, they were trying to sell the idea to a pretty skeptical group of investors. Peter Thiel was their first big investor. Elon Musk was another big investor early on. And so they were really showing progress. They're really impressing the wider world with, you know, the models they were building. But they realized, like, we're spending all of our time raising money rather than, you know, we as the founders working on the models themselves. So in 2014, they decided to sell to Google for $650 million. So, you know, the idea being that they could spend their brain time creating the products rather than trying to run a business and raise money.
Important to establish Suleiman's genius, which is management of this drive to succeed with AI. He has a very high demand level of people all around him. He is destined to succeed all the time. I note I miss the fact that he's a Syrian. His father went to Pakistan and met a British citizen, and that's why he wound up in London, because his mom and dad then would go home to London. So he has a influence from a variety of cultures.
But grew up very poor. I mean, they lived in the British equivalent of public housing, you know, early in their life. They, you know, he worked not even as a British taxi driver, but, you know, more of an illegal taxi driver, you know, kind of on the side, would kind of pick up people and not, you know, the traditional black cabs that we imagine. So, you know, they live very modestly. But the word visionary, I think, is overused. But to me, Suleiman is your classic visionary. He wasn't a technologist himself. Either is Reid Hoffman in that sense. They weren't like great computer programmers, but they really understood where this technology was going and what they needed to do to capitalize on it. What's interesting about Suleiman is, so in 2014, when Google bought the company, so he's now working for Google, and he thought, you know, all the potential here, right? Google was very early in machine learning and artificial intelligence. They were ahead of every other major company in jumping on machine learning. And he thought, wow, what a great opportunity. But it was a very frustrating experience for him. You know, the other side of the equation with Google is it's a big company that had, you know, tens of billions of dollars in revenue, and they worried about the chatbots they were creating, because it might threaten their search revenue, it might threaten their profit. So they, in 2020, essentially had ChatGPT. They had this product called Mina, but they were scared of it. You know, the PR consequences, if this chatbot says something, you know, untoward, something racist, something misogynist. And so he was just like banging on the table, let's get this out. There's going to be a race. Let's win this race. And he lost that battle. And so in 2022, at the start of 2022, he left Google to co-found a company.
What happens that DeepMind becomes Google. And there's a moment again, the music rises from the orchestra, and Elon Musk enters the stage. All right, as I understand it, Gary, and correct me if I've got the details wrong, Musk, Suleiman, and his co-founders showed Elon Musk once upon a time that their deep mind could play a game, could learn a game and then become very good at it quickly over a period of hours. And on a flight somewhere with either Brin or Page, one of the
Yeah, Larry Page, yeah.
Larry Page. Musk wanted to show Page what he'd seen done by DeepMind, so he showed him the game. That's when Google decided, what is this? Had Google been working on AI until that moment?
Right. So I mean, again, give Google credit. So 2014 is when they bought DeepMind, but you know, in the early 2010s, as way back as 2010, you know, they were starting to load up on AI talent. In the 2000s, they were actually using artificial intelligence to help decipher garbled Google searches, you know, misspellings and stuff. The AI would fix that. And so going back to the story you're telling about, you know, Musk showing Larry Page on a plane, DeepMind, like, it was incredible. They would, in the morning, the model would know nothing about some common video game. By noon, it was really good at it. By the end of the day, it could beat anybody at the game. And that really just showed the potential that, again, these neural networks that they can, you know, learn through feedback. They could learn in the fashion of a human being. And it really kind of excited, animated, you know, the likes of Elon Musk and Larry Page. So, in fact, in 2014, Page went to London and they bought DeepMind. But what was interesting is it frightened Elon Musk that AI was going to be in the hands of a few big companies. So Google buying DeepMind, like, and so Musk, Sam Altman, a few others came up with the idea for OpenAI, this idea, that, and they started as a nonprofit, this idea that with something as powerful as artificial intelligence, it shouldn't be the profit motive that runs things. Safety was essential. Safety and trust are essential to AI. So OpenAI started as a nonprofit with the express idea of being a countervailing force to the likes of Google controlling artificial intelligence.
Now, there's an important detail here about AI. When you use AI, everybody rolls their eyes and go, I don't understand it. What I learned from you, Gary, I'm just checking, that AI, we have all around us. We just don't call it AI anymore after it's part of our world. Google Maps is AI. Correcting the spelling of typing for a search is AI, correct?
Yes, and autocorrect. Google Translate's been around since around 2015. You know, more than a billion people around the world use it. Google Translate is AI. You know, you go to Netflix and they recommend you might like this show, this movie. You know, that's artificial intelligence. You know, to make one distinction here, you know, the chatbots that people use, these text-to-video programs that people use, that's generative AI. This idea that you could just give it a prompt, you know, write me a 3,000-word report, draw me a picture, make me a little video clip based on my instructions. That's generative AI, that it can generate something original. It's not just finding that thing. A favorite example of mine is right after OpenAI released ChatGPT, someone said, explain Karl Marx's economic theories as a Taylor Swift song. And it was brilliant. It was funny. And it wasn't like it went and found, oh, someone had already done this. It generated itself, generative AI.
We need to move to another approach to AI, and Gary's previewed it right here. It's the approach of OpenAI, which will become a major melodrama eventually. The book is AI Valley, Microsoft, Google, and the $1 trillion Race to Cash In on Artificial Intelligence. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, spending time with Gary Rivlin. His new book is AI Valley. Revelatory. If you puzzle about AI or you've poked around in it or you're holding back, there's no reason. These are the same people who brought you the social network we spend our days on. These are the same people who brought you the genius of LinkedIn and other very helpful programs that we can't remember how we lived without them. All right. Now we go to an important development. I have it down to 2017, but it might be a different year. The Transformers paper about large language models. What is that, Gary? How does it contribute?
Right. So a group of researchers inside of Google came up with the Transformer paper. And, you know, just essentially it's just like a human doesn't necessarily read word by word. You understand things in context. And so the Transformer paper was a way of allowing computers to divine a meaning from the context in which the word, the phrase was being used. And that would be essential. It would be essential to kind of the chatbots that we're all used to. Before that, they weren't really having very much luck getting computers to talk in natural language, in English or whatever language they were being taught in. But the Transformer paper really kind of helped folks or helped the people developing AI create chatbots that could talk to us in normal language. In fact, you know, ChatGPT, the T in GPT is for Transformer. So Google created this. This does not exist anymore. But back in the 2010s, it was much more open. Google's engineers made this breakthrough, and rather than just owning it for themselves as a competitive advantage, they published the paper. And so anyone was free to use this technology. In fact, OpenAI immediately jumped on it. There was an engineer there that was really just knocking their head against the wall with this natural language. And as soon as he saw the Transformer paper, that was the aha. That's when, like, oh, suddenly this thing could start doing things, and within a couple of years to be the first version of GPT, and eventually, at the end of 2022, ChatGPT.
Sam Altman, born 1985 in Chicago, Illinois.
St. Louis.
St. Louis, thank you. What we have here is the other personality who dominates the conversation even now, but he begins as the partner in Y Combinator. Spend a little moment, Gary, understanding the VCs and the part they play in all this. What is Y Combinator? Where is it?
Yeah, Y Combinator dates back to the 2000s. It's really extraordinary. It's kind of the step before venture capital, the angel investing. So, you know, a couple of folks have a really good idea, and they want that seed money to get it started. So Y Combinator will provide the seed money. And more than that, it's almost like a three-month boot camp. You know, they have they call them batches. So, you know, used to be two a year, now they're four a year. You apply for it, you get this money, and this intensive training to, like, make it so you get that product out there and you start to understand how to get users, how to iterate, how to improve it and all. And so Altman was actually in the first batch ever. He was at Stanford as a sophomore, created a company called Looped, which, you know, didn't survive, but they got money from Y Combinator, you know, would end up raising tens of millions of dollars. It didn't work out. But then Altman, at around 30 years old, took over Y Combinator. It's very influential in Silicon Valley. A lot of, you know, great companies, Airbnb is maybe the most famous of the companies, but they have a slew of hits. And so it's almost like a startup machine. Altman in 2015 running Y Combinator, but he goes to this dinner where Elon Musk and a few others are out, and this was the birth of OpenAI. Altman had is like, okay, I'll be part of the team behind this. I'll be on the board. I'll put in some money, but I'll let others run it. But by 2018, 2019, he would take over as CEO of OpenAI, which really is, you know, the machine learning, the AI company, the most, you know, transformative, the most influential AI company, you know, of them all, at least startups.
Right. Now, DeepMind goes to Google, and that's important. But OpenAI doesn't want to go to anyone, but it links up with Microsoft. Why?
Well, so it started off as a nonprofit. It started off as this idealistic vision. And, you know, a nonprofit in Silicon Valley can raise tens of millions of dollars. And, you know, Reid Hoffman threw in a wrote a $10 million check. I think Musk ended up putting in almost $100 million. But they soon realized, the folks behind OpenAI, that this stuff is really expensive. You have to buy the chips, you need the computer power, you need to buy the talent. And talent at that point, you know, for experienced machine learning person, you could pay them $1 million a year, if not more. So they realized they really needed more money, that they needed billions of dollars, not tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. So they came up with this idea in 2018. This is Altman's genius, of having a for-profit subsidiary. And so it would be run by a nonprofit, but the for-profit, you know, could make money. And they turned to Microsoft. Microsoft in 2019 put $1 billion in. A few years later, they put another $10 billion in. Because again, you know, when I started my research at 2023, the start of 2023, you know, it would be tens of millions of dollars to train one of these systems, one of these models like ChatGPT. You know, by now it's like billions of dollars to train them. And in fact, they think within a year or two, it could be hundreds, you know, $100 billion to train one of these. So it requires really big money. So the idea of a nonprofit doing this was no longer possible.
Sam Altman as a boss, and how does that compare and contrast to Suleiman? Are they different scale of bosses or are they similar?
Well, they're both very, very intense. Suleiman would get in trouble for like yelling at people because they weren't moving, you know, fast enough. You know, Altman, you know, he's an interesting character. He's, you know, unlike some computer geniuses, he's very personable. He's charming. He's a great strategist. He's really, you know, extraordinary. Figure, it would come out later, is a little bit of a slippery figure. People couldn't trust him as much. And, you know, that's essential with AI. You know, I mean, the folks who are giving us AI are asking us like, hey, we're going to have personal agents who will serve as your assistants, you know. Well, we're trusting them then with a lot of our private information. You know, these AI systems are going to be central to our personal lives, you know, to businesses. And so there really is a big sense of trust. And so kind of my criticism of Altman, again, an extraordinary figure, remarkably successful, is that he's really putting the safety and trust issues that help create OpenAI in the background, because now it's a competition. Now it's a race to win. Now it's a race to cash in and become that next trillion-dollar company.
Would you characterize them as micromanagers or big picture?
Oh, you know, big picture folks. You know, it's I think Altman's gift, which is the gift of a lot of CEOs in Silicon Valley, is they know how to hire the right people, you know, and they know how to like keep the folks on task. Their job, Altman's job, is to raise the money. Altman's job is to put together the team that's going to do these incredible things.
I'm speaking with Gary Rivlin. The book is AI Valley, Microsoft, Google, and the $1 trillion race to cash in on artificial intelligence. We're going to go really big picture. When we come back, the doomers versus the accelerationists. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.